All right, my friends, I'm going to start. You keep on eating. Excuse my back. The Jewish community in South Africa provides an example of the difficulties of being a minority in a country that is always in flux and has great problems to it. I'm speaking about political and governmental problems. As has been taught to us a number of times, the Dutch came here first, and the Dutch, even though in Holland the Jews were able to live more or less in freedom, certainly in comparison to what was going on in the rest of Europe in the 1500s, nevertheless the Dutch Reformed Church, which was a Protestant church, and you have to remember the bitterness of the 30 Years' War in Europe between the Catholic and Protestants, a war that killed thousands and thousands of people, destroyed countries, and left permanent divisions which exist until today in Europe, even though today it may not be a matter of religion, but it still is a matter of culture and nationality. So the Dutch Reformed Church insisted that anyone that is affiliated with Dutch colonialism be a member of the Dutch Reformed Church. And therefore, even though Jews came to South Africa with the Dutch, they behaved in a clandestine fashion. They were underground. They were like the Muranos were in Spain. Now, the Dutch East India Company, there were two companies that the Dutch had, the Dutch East India Company and the Dutch West India Company. The West India Company operated Suriname and Curacao and other parts of the Caribbean and even some of South Africa, South America. The Dutch East India Company was concentrated here in Africa and in Asia. The Dutch West India Company was a very tolerant place, and Jews could officially assume public roles, etc. And in fact, Peter Stuyvesant, who was anti-Semitic and who banned Jews from living in New York and New Amsterdam when he founded the city, was removed by the parent company in Amsterdam for his behavior towards the Jews. Excuse me. The Dutch East Indian Company was a company that had a great many Jewish stockholders. These were public companies. These were investments. They dealt naturally with spices and gold and whatever would be discovered. The Dutch East India Company, however, retained the restrictions on who could participate, and they were therefore the Jewish presence in South Africa was hidden. Now the Dutch came here, colonized it, and this was a Dutch colony in the 1700s, again, because of religious warfare in France between the Protestants, the Huguenots, and between the Catholics, and then later between the time of the French Revolution. A large number of French came here, French Huguenots, who, since they were Protestant, even though they were not part of the Dutch Reformed Church, were accepted in the country. In the late 1700s, the 1795, England comes to the country. They need a refueling station. They come to the Cape, but they were not successful in holding on to it nor in settling it. But in 1806, in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, England realizes that it needs South Africa desperately in order to maintain its roots to Asia, in order to build itself into the great empire that it became. And this time they came in force, and they were successful, and they took over Cape Town. The Cape colony was British. The Dutch resisted the British bitterly. They felt that the British were impugning on their territory, etc. And then 100 years later, right at the beginning of the 1900s, the British attempted here to expand out of the Cape Colony, and they drove the Dutch out. That's the great fortrek that the Dutch settlers moved into the Transvaal and moved into this part of South Africa. They were driven from the Cape Colony. And then there was the Boer War, which lasted a number of years, and killed over 20,000 British soldiers. But the British then, they invented concentration camps. They invented the name and the concept, where all of the Boers, the women and the children of the Boer farmers, were held in these camps. And the British called them concentration camps, to hold people together. And literally, they were held hostage. The Boers were a fierce opponent. And there were very many famous generals on the side of the Boers. The most famous one that perhaps we can remember is Jan Christian Smuts, who has streets named after him in the land of Israel, who was... And later, he lived through till the end of the Second World War, and he was a very great friend of Israel and the Jewish people. And he later became a prime minister here of the Union of South Africa. After the Boer War, England takes over. When England takes over, so then there's religious freedom. There still is discrimination against the local population. England always saw itself as the task of bringing culture to uncultured societies, to what they considered primitive societies. And especially English missionaries were active throughout the country. The Anglican Church became very strong here. Desmond Tutu was the bishop of the Anglican Church. And the Dutch established what they call the Orange Free State, and here in the Transvaal, where they were like independent of England. But after a period of time, because of economic and political measures, etc., all of South Africa was united into the Union of South Africa, all of the states, and it became a British dominion, and it was under British rule. But the English here never were the majority white population. The majority white population remained the Dutch, the Afrikaans, and they are the ones that, to a certain extent, had the greatest influence in the country. In the First World War, England was saved by the Commonwealth nations. Excuse me, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, etc., all sent troops. After realizing the First World War, England lost the first 3 months of the war, it lost its entire standing army. And England lost a third of the generation between the ages of 18 and 30 in the First World War. It was absolutely devastated. And the generals that it had were just such dunderheads. They did everything wrong. And instead of minimizing casualties, they maximized them. The British lost 50,000 men in one day in the Battle of the Somme. So England came to rely on the on its colonies. For instance, the famous Battle at Gallipoli in Turkey was fought by the Australians and New Zealanders mainly. And it was also a disaster. And South Africa contributed troops as well. After the war, the Union of South Africa, England opened up immigration here. And the immigration had a number of purposes. One purpose was to increase the white population. It was demographic. Secondly, it was to increase the productivity in the country. And this was a very wealthy country. Most colonies were a losing proposition. You lost the mother country lost money on it, in spite of all all the grandiose ideas. Most of them lost money. Spain lost money on their colonies. France lost money on their colonies. Germany went bankrupt there with the African colonies. But it was a matter of prestige to have colonies. England, however, made a profit always. England was able to rule India with 7,000 men to rule a population of hundreds of millions. And England made a very big profit here in South Africa on the gold and the diamonds and the other resources. And therefore, it wanted to increase population here. It wanted to make the country stronger. And because of that, after the First World War, tens of thousands of Jews immigrated here, especially from Lithuania. I described to you that the situation in Jewish Lithuania, Jewish Eastern Europe after the First World War was disastrous. You had the Communist Revolution on one side, you had the destruction of the war on the other side. You had the officially anti-Semitic governments that ruled Poland and Lithuania and Latvia. So people wanted to go out. In 1924, the United States passed a restrictive immigration act, which still is in effect, which limited immigration from Central and Eastern Europe to 50,000 people a year. So the Lord gave them Mexicans instead. But in the 1920s, from 1924 onwards, even till today, Jewish immigration from this part of the country, from the eastern part of Europe, was only a trickle. German Jews that came in the 1930s came on the German quota, which was much larger. And after the war, there were, because the quota was not used up during the war, we had a carryover. So therefore, after the war, a substantial number of Eastern European Jews could come to the United States on that quota. But for instance, Russian Jewry, when Russia started to fall apart in the 1970s, 1980s, and Russian Jews came to the United States, they came under a special act of Congress that allowed them to come, and not under the quota, because under the quota they could not have come. Then, since the United States was closed off, the United States was always the first, was the dream of Eastern European Jewry, for whatever reason. Shalom Aleichem has an article that if you just mentioned the word America, you know, that was the, it was not only the golden Medina, the golden land, America represented it much more as it does today also. It represented freedom and opportunity and a whole different way of life. And it represented an enormous country with enormous borders. The Jews used to joke that you could make a living in America because it had 48 states and therefore it had 48 borders. And, you know, there was plenty of room, right? But this golden in Medina, to a great extent, locked its doors. It was very hard to come. And therefore, tens of thousands of Jews came to South Africa. They came wherever they could. They came to Canada. They came to South Africa. And the Jewish community here grew. Now, the Jewish community here in South Africa was not self-sufficient. What happened was that the Jewish community built synagogues, beautiful synagogues. They imported rabbis from either England or from Lithuania, none of whom were indigenous to the country. The English rabbis established an English system here. And all the small towns, the Jews were in all the small towns here, wherever commerce took them. But they never established schools. It was pretty much what happened to the Jews in America. So that the second and third and fourth generation that had no recollection of Lithuania and had no real recollection of Jewish life pretty much assimilated. Though the assimilation here was not nearly as great as in the United States for a number of reasons. Number one, this was and is a traditional country. And since the non-Jewish world is traditional, the Jewish world was also forced to be somewhat traditional. The second thing was that in this country there was no conservative Judaism. There was no, there was a very, very small liberal reform stream. But there were, everything was Orthodox. So you were observant Orthodox or non-observant Orthodox, but everybody was Orthodox. And communities were organized according to the English system with a chief rabbi, with an official Bet Din that took care of everything. And marriage, divorce, etc., always were in the hands of the rabbinate. And because of that, you had this, Jewish connection. In South Africa, for instance, the Shabbos was destroyed almost immediately. But Friday night was not destroyed. On Friday night, till today, the families have their family dinners together. They go to the synagogue. The main service of the week is Friday night. The sermon is Friday night. The whole thing is Friday night. The chazan, the choir, the whole thing. And it has survived until today on that basis, which on one hand, can be considered disappointing, but on the other hand, in the United States, there's no Friday night either. It still is run under the same system as its chief rabbi today, Warren Goldstein, who's a wonderful young man, is the first South African-born chief rabbi. As I mentioned before, this for the first time now, South African Jewry is becoming self-sufficient. Now, the crisis, two great crises arose for the Jewish community in South Africa, three really. The first one was in the 1930s. Hitler comes to power. A large section of the Afrikaans population supports Hitler. They have bitter memories of the Boer War. They're against England. And Hitler, the Nazi Party, had agents here in South Africa. And they were promised that when the Germans win, they will take over the country. And because of that, they openly supported Hitler in the 1930s. They organized a political party. They called themselves the Gray Shirts. And part of the program of the political party was the anti-Semitism of Germany, the hatred of Jews, the discrimination against Jews. And Jews traditionally in this country gravitated towards the English and not towards the Dutch. In politics, in language, etc. And because of that, there was a terrible danger here. And in order to forestall the danger, England did the same thing here that happened in Palestine at that time. They cut off immigration of Jews. So at the moment when the Jews needed more than any other time the ability to go somewhere, you couldn't go here either. Beginning in 1935, Jewish immigration into the country was severely, severely limited. So that they. So then the question is, what do you do with the government, right? What's your relationship with it? Jews traditionally always supported the government, and traditionally they never tried to make waves. They always tried to, you know, have a low profile. Country that had millions of Afrikaans and English and has tens of millions of natives in the country. And Jews were small, but nevertheless they were influential and they were very successful. So this ended in 1939 when England went to war against Germany. When England went to war against Germany, it mobilized again all of its colonies. And this man, as I mentioned, Jan Christian Smuts, who was an Afrikaans hero, one of their great heroes from the Boer War, he became the prime minister of the country. And he brought the country completely on the side of the Allies, completely on the side of the English. And the anti-Semitism in the country was dampened. Didn't disappear, but it was dampened. During the war, the South Africans contributed, again, troops and supplies and money and everything they could to the Allied war effort. The war ends, England is broke. It cannot support an empire. So it has to pull out from everywhere. It promises independence to India, and it has to give it. We know the story in Palestine that it couldn't stay there. It withdraws from its empire throughout the world, and one of the places it withdraws from is South Africa. So South Africa now becomes an independent state within the British Commonwealth, but it's an independent state, just like Canada is an independent state. So today the Commonwealth is pretty much restricted to athletic games, etc. But it's all over. In the election of 1948, when South Africa becomes independent, first of all, the natives were excluded from the election. You had to pass a certain literacy test and etc. So for basically they were excluded. The Afrikaan Party won because they were the majority of the country of the whites. And they had this idea, Dr. Malan, he had this idea. He was a pro-Nazi, anti-Jewish prime minister. But he had the idea that the only way to safeguard the Afrikaans in the country is to completely separate the races. And by separating the races and keeping the blacks out of any political role whatsoever, the Afrikaans could rule here forever. The demographics were against him. You know, he had 5 million whites and 30 million blacks. And short of repression, there's no way for that to be maintained. And then there was a debate as to whether Jews were whites or blacks, because the division of the races, so they pretty much made it up as they went along, right? You had Indians here, so they decided that the Indians are white, but the Malays are colored. Because they needed the Indian, in India, whatever, you know, it made no sense. But they made up the rules. And because they made up the rules, so then they could do whatever they want. So there was a debate as to whether or not Jews were white. So the Jews were Jewish. The Jewish community was placed in this awkward position of having to defend this awful law in order that they themselves should somehow be able to exist in the country. And that was the quid pro quo, so to speak. You don't make waves, and you don't tell us all your liberal ideas, and you don't, you don't make nice. You behave yourself, and you're white. And that basically was the arrangement for a long period of time. There was a chief rabbi here. There was a rabbi, was Rabinowitz a chief rabbi? Yeah, Louis Rabinowitz. So later emigrated there to Israel. He was always a dynamic and controversial figure. He was the first one to speak out. He really spoke out. He spoke out in the 1960s already, for which he was rewarded by having to move to the land of Israel. But there were rumblings already in the Jewish community against these laws. Now, the apartheid laws became stronger and stronger as time went on, because of the fact that the government saw that it really was losing the battle instead of winning the battle. And the head of the Communist Party in Israel, the head of the Communist Party here in South Africa, was a Jew by the name of Joe Slovo. Now, Slovo, his real name was Soloveitchik. And he changed his name because he did not want to bring embarrassment to the family. He was a direct descendant of the Beis Halevi. And he operated for decades. So the Communist Party here, and the left generally here, were the main opponents of apartheid. So here they had a moral ground that, for instance, they did not have in other places. And because of this moral ground, they enjoyed the respect. When Slovo died a few years ago, I think 2 years ago, something like that, thousands of people came to the funeral. He was eulogized by the president of the country. Because of his efforts against apartheid. There were many, many Jews that were active against apartheid. But the Jewish community as a whole had a very low profile. And it would not be until the 1980s that the Board of Deputies, the official Jewish organizations, would take a public stand against it. So what happened was that the Jews found themselves in a vice. The black said, "How come you waited 30 years to say anything? Why didn't you help us then?" And the white said, "How come you're talking against the government and you're talking against the government's official policy of apartheid?" So that became a situation where you couldn't win. It was further complicated by the State of Israel. The wonderful thing about the State of Israel is that it has made great complexities for Jewish life throughout the world. Nothing is simple because of that. Now, South Africa, the apartheid government of South Africa, did tremendous business with the State of Israel. And most of the business had to do with arms and with training of police, etc., etc. South Africa supplied Israel with a lot of valuable raw materials when no one else would sell it to them. It provided Israel with, helped make it a diamond center in the world. And Israel paid South Africa back by training South African police, shipping Uzi guns, by doing all sorts of things that aided the apartheid government. And this was especially true when the world declared sanctions against South Africa, and it was diplomatically and financially isolated. Israel did not join in the sanctions. There always were planes that flew here. It always maintained a relationship with the country. South African Jews were notoriously Zionistic. There was a small but steady aliyah to Israel. And in fact, Abba Ibn is probably the main example of a South African Jew who achieved a great deal in Israel. But there was the great company, the Africa Israel Investment Company, is one of the largest in Israel today as a development company. And so therefore they are placed in this terrible vice. What do you do? And in the United Nations, they always said there were two pariah countries in the world. One was South Africa and the other was Israel. And when the United Nations voted to expel South Africa, that was the time also when you had the Zionism is racism resolution passed. And except for the tenacity of the United States, undoubtedly Israel would have also been expelled. Because you had no. Of course, we can always rely on the fact, you know, that we have two little islands in the Pacific that always vote with us. So we're not alone, but basically we're alone. And so there was a certain I don't know how to put it. There was a certain empathy with a country that was isolated, even though the reasons for the isolation were undoubtedly just. And the isolation itself led to the destruction of apartheid in the country. Now, you had, therefore, when there was a group of nations called the non-aligned nations. Now, the non-aligned nations were the Arab world, the Asian world, the black world, Africa. Israel invested a great deal in Africa. In the 1950s and 1960s, they helped develop agriculture here. They sent like Peace Corps people to work here. They invested money. They helped the emerging countries. But in 1967, when the Six-Day War ended, Russia broke diplomatic relations with Israel. And it forced the African countries to do so as well. The Yom Kippur War sealed that, so that almost all the investment that Israel had put into Africa went down the drain. And Israel, again, was the pariah state. Here, what it accomplished here is that the Afrikaner's stance against Jews in Israel was, so to speak, modified because of the fact that Israel helped. But as apartheid grew in its evil, and the resistance of the blacks increased, the rioting and all sorts of L.B. Sachs, that you saw in that movie, he's a judge in the Constitutional Court, that's the Supreme Court. I had the honor and pleasure of meeting with him one of my visits here. So he lost an arm because the government's police force sent him a letter bomb. And when he opened it, his arm blew off, his hand blew off. But there are many other Jews that supported the blacks, and Helen Suzman, all sorts of people. But overall, the policy of the black government over the past 10, 12 years has been pro-Arab, anti-Israel, because they remember the past, and also because they see the Arabs as being oppressed, colonialized, They see them as being, as being victims. And because of that, there is a certain strain in the relationship here that's hard to bridge, and it will remain hard to bridge. When the black government took over, there was a great deal of optimism in the country that this was going to be really the great thing. But there was a great surge in crime, person on person, person on property crime. Because of that, there was a large exodus. They say South African Jewry at one time numbered 120, 125,000 people. It went down to about 70,000. And especially younger people left. They left for Australia, they left for Canada, they left for the United States. They left because they did not see any future. I think the situation is stabilized today. There still is immigration, but it's not in great numbers. And there are numerous South Africans who have returned to live in South Africa because even with the crime and everything else, the quality of life that a person has in South Africa, they cannot have anywhere else in the world. So the community's in flux. The community here was very strongly influenced by Chabad, by Lubavitch, when others were not coming to build here at Torah. Chabad built schools, big schools. And the Rebbe said that no one's allowed to leave South Africa until the time of the Messiah. And so no one left. Whereas many of the Rabbonim and many of the other people who were could have been the backbone of the community did leave. A lot of people went to Manchester and other. I don't know why anybody would go to Manchester except for the weather, but the there are a lot of South Africans in there.